Welcome to the In Common podcast. This is Stefan Partolo. Today I'm speaking with Josephine Chambers. Josie is an assistant professor at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, situated within the Urban Futures Studio at the Copernicus Institute of Sustainable Development. Her research develops and examines approaches to questioning so-called inevitable unjust futures and fostering collective imagination and agency towards more just and sustainable societies. She weaves together artistic, participatory, imaginative, and decolonial concepts to collaboratively explore possibilities for transformative changes with diverse societal groups. In the podcast, we speak about two papers Josie and colleagues published analyzing co-production research, one titled Six Modes of Co-production for Sustainability, published in Nature Sustainability, and the other titled Co-productive Agility and Four Collaborative Pathways for Sustainability Transformations, published in Global Environmental Change. Both are linked in the show notes, and we also discuss the role of creativity in science and how linking art, creativity, and science together has potential to extract pluralistic sustainability narratives for just futures. Josie also explains how she brings her knowledge and passion for co-production and creativity into the classroom to reshape learning and student engagement. Please enjoy my conversation with Josie Chambers. Just introduce a little bit of your path and background into academic work, maybe where you went to school and what you studied.
Sure. So I grew up in Champaign, Illinois. So very much in the heart of the cornfields, but a nice university town. And I actually studied biology there. So my first research job was studying honeybee brains, honeybee genomics for 4 years. But then slowly I started to, I guess for me personally, feel the limits or constraints of that quite narrow focused frame, and started to ask increasingly questions about, well, how does the knowledge that I'm generating as a researcher actually connect to some sort of purpose or potential change in the world? And that led me to gradually broaden my frame more and more, originally to studying monkeys in the wild, and then asking questions more so about the different kinds of nature conservation and community interventions that operate in that space, and then more so into the politics of these kinds of interventions. And I have to admit, I got a little bit frustrated with only being in the role of that critical space of critiquing what's failing, and that really led me into co-production because I was really curious to learn a lot more about diverse approaches and methodologies to collaboratively bringing different people together to hopefully do a little bit of a better job at addressing all sorts of challenges that we see around us. And that's led me more into a particular corner of co-production, the co-production space, I would say, especially around imagination, artistic approaches, non-Western perspectives that I'm really trying to develop more and more actively, both as a researcher, but also a creative practitioner.
Wonderful. Is that where you did your PhD as well?
So I did my PhD at Cambridge, University of Cambridge. That's right. And my master's at but also the University of Edinburgh before that. So have gone across a few different countries, and now I'm based at Utrecht University in the Netherlands in the Urban Futures Studio.
Wonderful. Yeah, you made the jump across the Atlantic like I did. I find it interesting that did you already have those types of reflective things early on in like your bachelor work before you went into the PhD, that there was kind of this missing link of those political aspects of those, what is this knowledge useful for and what's its purpose? You weren't just, you know, struggling to get the papers out and graduate.
Yeah, I think I've always been very motivated by purpose. I suppose initially as a scientist, I was really motivated by the curiosity of science itself and that sort of question. So it probably took me a while to actually combine that curiosity with that sense of social purpose. But also I almost went into music instead of biology. So music and creativity has always been a passion of mine. And I also kept that separate from my role as a researcher for far too long. So I would say it's also only been in the past 5 years or so that I've realized actually how enriching creativity and the arts are to who I am as a researcher, and how that research can be much more socially engaged in its approach. So it's nice to kind of see these different threads actually somehow find their way together over the years.
Did you feel like you had to keep them separately earlier on in your career or in your training? Was it kind of like an implied thing, or was it told to you, or what was the reason for this early on?
I guess it was more just a lack of awareness of how they could come together. Because when you're spending 20 hours a week in a lab staring through a microscope and trying not to flick a honeybee brain halfway across the room, it's such a narrow frame or specific frame in which you are thinking about research and the role of science. So I think it took me a really long time trained in that way to actually see that science could be something deeply creative, participatory, political from that initial quite focused frame of what science means.
How much of your work would you say is creative? I've had this discussion with some colleagues the other day, and some were on the spectrum of science is not really creative at all. It's just about implementing what we know and just doing things in the procedurally. And then some of I was more on the spectrum of like almost everything I do is creative, like how I formulate an email, how I think about what my routine for the
Yeah.
day. So how do you go about thinking about the role of creativity in your kind of day-to-day science experience?
Yeah, I would say it's played more and more of a role from year to year, almost to the point where sometimes I ask myself whether it plays too much of a role, because it's very easy to spend, say, 5 hours doing something in a really creative and intrinsically enjoyable way, when you could just kind of do it in a simpler way in a half hour or an hour. So I'm also maybe also having to be a little bit more pragmatic about when does it make sense to really kind of engage with this in a deeply creative way, and when do I just need to be a little bit more pragmatic because there are so many things also that we need to get done in our sorts of academic jobs.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of I guess a challenge to decide where to draw the limits of creativity because it is something that I enjoy so much.
Yeah, do you see science as it seems now that you would see it as like a creative outlet for yourself? I think I also see it more as a creative outlet for myself, but probably because I spend too much time doing science and not as much stuff playing music or doing the other things. So I kind of try to manifest my interests through doing science.
Yeah, and maybe an important shift in my approach of how I see the power of creativity as well is, I suppose, when I initially started to combine creativity with my research, I probably saw it a little bit more in terms of its power to represent ideas, such as through the musical abstract that I created for the co-productive agility paper. But then I also kind of realized through the process of making that abstract that also led me to reflect in different ways on what co-production means. And over time, I've really come to see the power of creativity as a method for research and change. And I think if we only try to kind of take ideas and then creatively represent them, we're really also undermining the power and the potential of creativity also to democratize whose voice matters and how it matters. And of course, representation is a very important part of that, but then the end or the aim doesn't become just to pin down some form of creative representation, but actually to use it more so as a boundary object to surface different perspectives and worldviews, with the purpose of being more critical and challenging each other in a more open way to hopefully move towards something that is beyond our initial starting interests of what should be represented.
When did you first get into co-production? When did you hear about the term, and what like sparked your initial kind of direction in research towards co-production?
That's a very good question. I think it must have been near the end of my PhD. So at that time, I had been researching conservation and development programs in northern Peru, and I saw a lot of the ways that these different organizations were struggling. And I had tried to find some ways of intertwining the critical research that I was doing also to spark conversations and dialogue with different organizations, also different community members in the areas where they were working to think about how this could be done differently. And so I suppose I was in, like, amidst the struggles of a co-production process, also realizing that I lacked a lot of the kinds kinds of skills that one needs, even just how to facilitate or design that kind of space well. So I was realizing a lot of the limitations of my approach at the same time that someone from what used to be called the Lou Kauffman Institute approached me, and they said, "Oh, we would love to have a review of different co-production processes. Would you be interested in doing that for your postdoc following your PhD?" And I mean, I'm sure I had heard of co-production in from kind of a Jasanoff sense of the co-production of discourse and society, but I don't think that I had really looked much kind of in depth methodologically in terms of all of the different experiments and ways of framing that. So that led me to really look around and see, oh wow, there are a huge number of ways that people are approaching this. And in fact, the terms like transdisciplinarity and co-design, there's so many different terms also that people were floating around to talk about the ways in which research and processes of societal change come together. And so that really, I think, opened up my interest in then focusing on how we can create knowledge in a much more socially engaged and political way, and focusing much more on that process as opposed to just what knowledge am I generating as a researcher. So I guess that was my entry point.
Yeah. Do you feel there's a misunderstanding of what co-production is, or kind of different ways that people interpret the term or what it stands for in your view?
I think people definitely see it in many different ways. And in fact, we saw this as well in our process of looking at 32 different initiatives. People were interpreting co-production in many different ways. I think it was interesting that there was always this debate of, are we talking about knowledge co-production or are we talking about co-production? Because historically, people working in that space very often spoke about knowledge co-production. And I always had a little bit of this uncomfortable feeling of privileging knowledge, even in the naming of that process, especially because as we were looking at these different initiatives and approaches, it became clear that the dominance of knowledge in itself as a valuable outcome was actually oftentimes limiting the kinds of implications, social implications of these projects, because there was such a dominant assumption of still of this linear transfer that as long as you co-produce the knowledge, then it will be actionable and powerful for society, as opposed to already bringing in reshaping values, reshaping institutions or regulations as part of that production of knowledge. So that was one main distinction that we noticed, but then all sorts of assumptions, different assumptions around what's important to privilege in that sort of the design of that sort of co-production process.
Yeah, I think that was probably the most striking finding of the paper from your six modes of co-production paper. It was that, if I say it right, that the projects who focused on producing knowledge together traded off against other valuable types of outputs. I would be interested to hear a little bit more about why there was a trade-off in the projects that you analyzed between those who focused on producing knowledge and those producing other out types of outputs or actions.
Yeah, and I can, in fact, I can even talk about my PhD work as well, because my PhD work was very much one of those cases that I think struggled more from a critical social science perspective of giving the researcher, in that case myself, too much power, which is very difficult not to do that in the frame of a PhD, because you have so much pressure to work towards this key knowledge output. Which really needs to be your intellectual production and contribution. And so I would say in that process, then I had a lot of, well, while I tried to collaboratively interact with organizations, communities, two Peruvian friends slash researchers who worked with me, I still probably had too much control over how everything was framed and what was studied, which is really difficult to avoid in that sort of setup. And as a result, when I first, so I the first step following my research was to design a 2-day dialogue, and I still probably fell into the trap a little bit of communicating the critical research findings, which were not necessarily in the interest of different organizations to change according to those findings. And so I still probably fell a little bit into the trap of if you just kind of speak truth to power, to the group that can make the change, then that will have an impact. And I saw through follow-up engagements that it was much more powerful to explore in further depth with these organizations how they were experiencing certain challenges, and also surfacing how the way that they were framing the problem, why deforestation was happening, and certain solutions that were assumed to be the most effective, how that was very kind of partial and also self reinforcing, and that the ways that they were monitoring success were designed to reinforce that worldview and that interpretation of the problem. So almost like more openly exploring the partiality of that perspective and introducing them to some of these really diverse co-production methods that different people are trying out that are quite inspirational in terms of, for example, giving organizations and communities more of a balance of power as opposed to organizations coming in with their view of what model, intervention model is successful. I found that that more collaborative learning space was infinitely more powerful than my initial instinct to kind of present the findings as a researcher.
So you, in the paper, you have these four themes: purpose, power, politics, and pathways. How did you come up with those particularly four as the kind of quintessential dynamics that you would want to look at within co-production processes?
That was a very actually long and iterative process because when we first started doing this work, we gathered a certain number of initial cases and we had a workshop in Oaxaca, Mexico as part of a PECS conference. And we started to talk about, okay, what are some of the interesting ways in which these different initiatives vary? And then we thought, oh, we're missing different kinds of co-production cases. How can we increase the diversity of what we're looking at? So it was then this process of adding more cases and then analyzing the materials, talking to a representative from each case, and realizing in even broader ways, like interesting set of ways in which these cases vary. And I think, if my memory serves, I think we ended up with about 106 dimensions of how all of these, which ended up being 32 cases, and how they all vary. And then it was really, I suppose there was a bit of kind of, an intuitive process of just going through all of that information and really trying to focus on what are the key distinctions that really seem to matter in terms of how co-production is being done. And that is what led us to really focus on those core dimensions and then do a cluster analysis so that we could see how cases were treating those different dimensions in quite similar or different ways to then do a further analysis of these different approaches. So, but it took a really long time. Like, that was, I think the original funding for that project was 5 months, and then that was extended to 9 months. And then it took me like at least 2 years following that to finish up the analysis and write the papers. And then also the paper for Nature Sustainability was also rejected after the second review round. So I had to write an appeal to Nature Sustainability to also argue why this unusual form of analysis and especially broad approach was still legitimate from a scientific perspective. And thankfully, we managed to still get it through. But it was really a very long process in the end.
Yeah, well, we'll link to the paper in the all the papers that we talk about today, we'll link to in the show notes for this episode for those interested. When I think about purpose and power and politics and also pathways, I see values and ethics playing an important role there. So what are people's different values? I think the values and ethics of doing research itself, and I think co-production raises a lot of issues about how we do research, why we do research, and the ways we do research. But also about how we deal with values and ethical issues as part of what's discussed in the co-production process. Did you address these types of issues at all in some, or did these issues come up in any of the case studies? Because I see them implicit in some of the themes that you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we went further in depth into those, into the ethics or the tensions and difficulties in the second paper around co-productive agility. Because the first one, we were really kind of so limited in this nature sustainability format that we just kind of focused on some of the major differences. But I do think that power and politics and there and purpose and pathways, I think that these really reflect some fundamental differences in how people approach co-production. And for example, whether knowledge is really privileged, or whether it is much more about creating and co-producing action, or whether the focus is on intervening with more powerful parts of the system, or really elevating more marginalized perspectives, which requires such a different sort of approach to co-production. Or whether co-production is trying, we definitely saw approaches that were trying to use participatory approaches in collaboration to pursue some sort of predefined goal, which seemed to be very, have very different implications than a co-production process that starts with very little predefined goal and is kind of hoping that that will emerge from that collaborative process. And so I guess these seemed like really fundamental things that shape the openness of a co-production process to the power of participants, depending on also who is involved in that process. But it's very, with these things, it's very difficult even to just consolidate something around or down to a certain number of dimensions or characteristics, because it's always so much more complex than that in terms of the ethical considerations. But hopefully it was at least some start at least to try to crack away at some of these important distinctions.
So I think a lot of the interest, perhaps also those listening, but also the interest in general in co-production is coming from science. So a lot of us think, ah, oh, that's a really good seemingly approach. I would like to do that in my research. So a lot of co-production are in practices and projects are initiated by scientists. But then from the finding from this other paper, if you're pursuing knowledge production, which is the goal of a lot of science, it can deter from some of the practical other impacts that you would like. So what is the role of like, how can that be balanced? I think you get to this and what you mean by co-productive agility, if I understand it correctly, that shifting kind of the goals along the way and being able to deal with different issues in different ways is really important. But how can we like start projects as scientists, be the initiators of them, but then step back? How does that work? And what was your reflections in this agility paper?
I think that's really a challenge, especially when researchers do have the power and the funding to decide what they actually want to do. But I definitely saw the limits of, especially from an overemphasis on knowledge and still assuming that linear transfer theory of change. So I saw the downsides of researchers having too much control, but I also saw the downsides of handing over too much control to societal actors to shape that agenda. Also, because it just really depends so much on the politics behind whose agenda and whose voice is then comes in to shape and ask for certain support in terms of or be legitimized by scientific knowledge processes. And if that is unquestioned, then that can also really limit the potential for knowledge to be transformative in these kinds of processes. And that I think that that also applies to local communities as much as powerful CEOs or policymakers, because also at the scale of a local community, issues are also constructed very much in that particular context, and it can be a real challenge to find more systemic framings of interventions that go that are maybe also really important for that local context and other local contexts that but that go up to a much higher level. So that's what we were trying to get at with this term of co-productive agility, is how do you foster this willingness and ability of diverse perspectives to be really genuinely open to learning and shaping their perspectives to orient towards some shared, possible, more transformative scope for action. And in terms of doing that in practice, so many different insights that came out, which we shared in that paper. But I think really having the space up front to genuinely build relationships, to co-design, is so important, because if you don't have that starting space to really get to know each other's perspectives before there's suddenly a lot of pressure to pin down what the frame is, then that's difficult to kind of do that after the fact. because it does require researchers or those who have power to step back and to give up some of that power of what they think is the best way to go about it. And I really think it's much easier to do that actually when the space is much, you could say, softer, in the sense that people can explore different ideas without the political pressure to already make a decision or already defend their standpoint. But creating funding that and creating space for that is always a challenge, also because there are people that want to know, why am I here? And if it doesn't immediately speak to their interests or seems very vague and fuzzy, it can be difficult to pull different people in. I think if you can find that higher level frame around, for example, justice, I think that can help bring people together, but still with quite a lot of openness.
One of the challenges I see with co-production is that in the literature, it's almost exclusively framed as normatively good. Like,
Yeah.
more co-production is better. We should just do that and we should do more of it. But I feel there's a little bit of a lack of critique of the challenges that arise in a lot of different projects, or even the failures that people tried co-production. It led to conflict. It didn't work. The project dissolved.
Yeah.
What has your experience been with that more unsuccessful side? I think part of it is reframing what success is. So if it's about building relationships, getting it might not be the knowledge creation goal that was initially envisioned. It might be about relationship building, understanding common problem frames, etc. But I think some of them will inevitably not be successful, or they will dissolve. Like, did you have experience with these types of projects?
I would say there's definitely this golden aura that people assume around co-production. And co-production processes also take so much time and energy and effort that I do think that we should be a little bit more judicious about when does it make sense to co-produce and on what depth or level. And there are also, I think, cases where it just makes sense to kind of go forward and go with energy by a narrower group of people. I think we really need to think carefully about how different agendas come together in co-production. And maybe what I'm most skeptical about is when the co-production frame is set within some sort of dominant frame and is trying to kind of bring in others to legitimize that frame, and not meaningfully create equal space. And I think it's difficult, like if you're in that marginalized perspective and you're being brought into something and there's promise of funding, but it's potentially a little bit of an instrumental role. I think sometimes it can be difficult to figure out whether you can transform that role into something more meaningful or whether that's actually just going to be too much of an uphill battle and you should just say no to that co-production or to that collaboration. And that's, yeah, I think that's difficult to figure out then where to put your energy in terms of whether to accept a co-production process or not. And of course we see this especially when there's power heavy power differences at play. There's really a risk that those who have less power might end up legitimizing or serving that dominant frame unless it's very openly designed to consider those kinds of power differences.
Yeah, well, power was one of the key themes in the Six Modes paper. And there you use the indicator or approach of, like, basically direct agency or systemic agency. So would you imply there that, like, this is kind of setting out a generic framework of what co-production could aim for, so and perhaps should aim for, is like a normative direction there. Like, it should aim to empower direct agency, or at least systemic agency, or both, or maybe there's a trade-off there in some way. Or do you see the paper as more of like, this is what we found in these cases, but there could be more and different approaches to doing that beyond this analysis?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, kind of the normativity of these different dimensions. And I certainly have also my own biases as well in that respect. I mean, I am really interested more in systemic forms of agency because I do think if we keep interpreting problems in quite superficial ways in terms of who is quote unquote to blame, then we oftentimes also reproduce a lot of the similar power relations that continue to cause these problems. And just to give a concrete example, I mean, I worked a lot with Peruvian farmers in my PhD research, and a lot of interventions were trying to shape individual smallholders' behavior and provide incentives so that they would slightly, hopefully slightly cut fewer areas of forest down. But that was such like a direct agency framing of the problem of blaming farmers for cutting down trees, and very much on that individual behavior change level, that framing I would say completely also depoliticizes the role of large companies who are chopping down much, much larger areas of forest in different areas of that same broad region. So I think that's the danger of this kind of narrower, more direct agency framing. But I mean, I do think systemic frames you can be very difficult to come to, and it really, like, as soon as you broaden your framing and understanding of the problem, it also makes you feel potentially a little bit more hopeless about your agency and ability to somehow address or engage with that broader frame. And especially if you're co-producing or working with groups that have been systemically marginalized, it's really important to prioritize, for example, Indigenous communities, it's really important to prioritize also those understandings and interpretations of the problem. So you wouldn't want to come in and say, oh, we should be first focusing on these systemic capitalist structures and kind of pave over actually what is the kind of the important and most meaningful understanding of the problem in that context. So that's why I think long-term relationships are so important in this context, to together co-construct and shift what is our understanding of the problem, and hopefully push to a more systemic or deeper understanding over time in a way that does allow us to connect different struggles for justice that might not necessarily be so apparently connected if you just go with that initial framing.
What would you say the role of learning amongst the project teams who originally started the projects is along the way? Did you get the sense that those who did the projects were well equipped and prepared and had all the right tools to face the challenges that the projects would bring? Because I'm interested in this idea of like learning iteratively throughout process the project, and perhaps making mistakes, and perhaps also this idea of unlearning and rethinking the way that the project should be, or the direction that we want it to be. Did you get a sense of that in the projects that you analyze?
I think that some prioritize learning more explicitly and actually had methodologies for learning together, whereas other projects it was really implicit, and that wasn't at all kind of the core focus. I mean, some actually wrote papers on the process of their learning, whereas for others that was not the target of their focus on knowledge production, for example. And in terms of different approaches, I do agree that the emphasis on unlearning is extremely important, because if we always frame learning as an additive or positive act, I think that really misses the importance of challenging and questioning certain assumptions that we have as a way of also opening up space to embrace different perspectives. In terms of how to do that best, that's a very good question. Yeah, gosh, in terms of approaches, I mean, I will say, okay, if I were to give one specific example, I do think that this works really well in the transformative research PhD course that I run with Esther Turnout, Maria Tango, and Jean Nell. And there, at least the way that we, well, that's not in the frame of a co-production project or initiative. It is an intentional learning space by which people can reflect on their narratives and their role in societal change. And I think what works so well about that sort of setup is that everyone has the mandate to be much more explicit about what their theory of change is, or what their assumptions are about their role as a researcher. But then, because they write that out before the course, we bring all of those together, and you see all of these differences in perspectives. And the whole course itself is really designed to provoke and challenge many of these assumptions about what the role of a researcher can be. But that's also where creativity and arts comes in, because we really encourage people to start to express their narratives through creative and artistic forms. And I think the positive passion and energy that comes from that, alongside being introduced to all sorts of critical perspectives, but also which allow people to lean more deeply into doubt and feelings of discomfort that they've felt like they've had to suppress beforehand. I think that combination really allows people to reflect and unlearn in ways that also they can actively create into a new narrative that comes out of the course. So I think that that's a process where I've seen it work well, and I think we could probably use these kinds of reflexive processes a lot more also within our collaborative initiatives. But it does take time and energy to do that.
I'm working on a paper now where we're kind of arguing that folks doing co-production research should consider and build some ethical and capacities in philosophy. So like drawing a bit on philosophy and learning a little bit more about ethics and how that can help the process. One of the critical comments that we received is that, well, we're asking co-production scholars and transdisciplinary scholars to do so much already. And I'm interested in your experience then in that PhD course with these PhD students, that, you know, we're asking transdisciplinary, even just interdisciplinary scholars to do much. You have to be an expert in your field. You have to be also interdisciplinary. You have to have leadership capacities, facilitation capacities. You have to do interviews, different methods, learn about ethics, so much. Do you get the impression that this kind of coming up generation is, like, how do they perceive that there's so much beyond just being a disciplinary specialist that one should consider? It seems a bit overwhelming.
I think it can feel daunting in terms of how to approach this, but I also think it almost feels like more of a burden if you're in the position of a researcher who you yourself has to produce the transformative knowledge that's going to go out there and somehow change the world in a positive way. You've actually kind of taken that burden on yourself, and especially if you feel deeply uncomfortable about some of the ways that you're producing knowledge or the assumptions that you're making, but you're not actually enabled to engage with those feelings of doubt and you feel like you have to suppress them. I actually think that that's almost a more difficult and anxiety inducing position to be in. Whereas if you're given some inspiration or some approaches of how you can actually not take on that burden yourself, but can design a sort of setup where you're also facilitating a space for others to think about what's valuable in this setting, I think in some sense that can be empowering and also allows, at least in this case, these PhD candidates to then feel like that's a way of doing research that engages more with their humanity and their ethics much more directly. Which can be quite empowering in certain ways. But also, I think a PhD is still a very constraining space within to do this sort of work. So I would say there's a pragmatic thread as well of kind of hopefully this is helpful to inform some of your approaches as a PhD candidate, but also think about think kind of more pragmatically within that context, but also think more radically, what might this mean for after your PhD trajectory when you have a wider range of potential frames that you can set or that you can engage with? Because I think then it's a bit of a pragmatic agency in the here and now, but also a more inspiring long-term sense of agency. And I think that balance is really important for people not feeling just overwhelmed with maybe what they're not doing.
Right. Where do you kind of see that your interest now in co-production? Do you have any particular gaps that you're interested in studying or projects ongoing that you're thinking about right now?
I would say the direction that I've most gone in over the past few years. So there are probably a few different elements of that. One is especially towards imagination, and especially more radical forms of imagination. And that interest has come from just seeing how co-production processes often start with the struggles of the present Oftentimes, we also call people stakeholders, like holders of these different stakes. And I think the ways, like the metaphors we use, but also the methodologies often pull us more into problems and more into existing ways of framing things. So I think it can be quite difficult actually to orient these kinds of co-production processes around people's collective dreams for the future of what's possible in much more open ways, but also ways that are critical of how we dream about the future, because we might just reproduce a lot of our assumptions in the present in the way that we also dream about the future. So I'm moving more and more towards co-production processes that really engage with imagination and opening up imagination in creative and also critical ways. And I think in order to do that well, that's what's led me towards artistic and creative methodologies and approaches, because there's something about the power of the arts that enables people to express themselves in much more emotional and open ways than I think we can get through this typical kind of cognitive Western Cartesian entry point. And that also bridges to another interest of mine, which is I think that Western methodologies have really dominated our co-production processes. And that really constrains how we can know, how we can imagine, who wants to be involved, how they can express themselves. So I'm also increasingly really interested in what are different alternative methodological approaches at the intersection of art, ethnography, critical social science, participatory approaches that give more genuine agency for people involved to know the world, express their views, and imagine in different kinds of ways, and to not put them so much in boxes by forcing certain dominant methodologies.
I think I'm imagining what it might be like, but would you have an example of a particular method or project that you're doing now that give a better sense of like
Kind of
how you would do
concretely
that
what this is.
methodologically?
At the moment, I'm involved in a few different projects that are going about this in different ways. They're all very much in the earlier stages. I suppose I can speak to more how we've thought about designing them as opposed to kind of explaining the full a process. Two examples. I have the privilege of working with two really wonderful PhD candidates. One is looking, so Cara Flores, she's looking at the ways that we often map sustainability challenges, often privileges very particular Western perspectives. And she's looking into what does it mean to facilitate more decolonial bottom-up mapping approaches. In particular, she's looking in two island settings. And so she's really kind of grappling with those methodological questions of how, when we're talking about a tool like mapping that has been so colonial in the way, in terms of what's been represent, how space has been represented and whose space has been represented, she's actively experimenting with research and artistic approaches and co-production processes to ask and explore how that could be done differently. And the other PhD candidate, Darko Lagunas, he is investigating similar questions, but in a very in a different context. So with the green energy transition that more and more support is mobilizing around, there are a lot of ignored questions, especially on the like the back end of these transitions. The fact that lithium and cobalt and many minerals that the transition is asking a much higher production of are located in indigenous territories, for example, and it's leading to all sorts of ignored negative consequences. And so he's exploring how do we become more critical of the colonial underpinnings behind the way that we think about green energy transitions, and what does it mean actually in those settings? So in this case in Chile, what does it mean to engage with different ways of knowing the world and ways of being in the world that are meaningful from that perspective, but also that counter these dominant ways of knowing the world that are actively producing negative consequences for those places. And so I think that those are two really interesting, both of their projects are really interesting examples, and they're both within the first year or so. So they're very much at the beginning of how do you become more critical of what you could say are kind of global or broader processes, and how do you connect that criticality of those global processes to locally oriented co-production processes that intertwine decolonial, artistic, and participatory methods to show the alternatives and also to problematize what's happening at a broader level.
Seems like a lot of this work is about valuing and understanding plural ontologies, or like plural ways of seeing and being and doing in the world. And I think that's sometimes a hard sell to a lot of the other parts of science, which are not familiar with those terms, with those processes. I mean, what are we doing over there? We're doing art. It's not science. I mean, you might get some of these comments from people outside of this kind of space. So have you been able to navigate that in the science system, and explaining like these values, and that we have to have and kind of the use of these very kind of innovative, I would say, artistic approaches to solve some of the problems, which a lot of others would say needs a lot of quantitative statistics, for example.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it also links to the growing critique of how what is often called objective knowledge is not so objective. So I think once you open up knowledge to recognizing the fact that it's deeply political in terms of where the frame is even set for what knowledge is being generated and why and by whom and how, I think once you take a political stance on the production of knowledge itself, you also have to take a critical stance on the privileging of knowledge over ways of feeling, ways of being. I think that it only kind of diversifying an emphasis of on knowledge only goes so far if you keep knowledge so isolated from also ways of feeling and being. So I think it's, yeah, in terms of actually, I guess you asked about how do you make that argument. Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and something that we need to explore further, because clearly, I think oftentimes we're not as good at justifying why we should use more time-intensive and more open methodologies. But I would say, if we actually care about transformation in the world, and if we really want to foreground the purpose of what our knowledge and the kinds of new relationships that we're forming as a result of those kinds of, and within those kinds of research processes, then if we ignore our fundamental emotions and passions, then I just see it's very difficult that we're kind of going to generate the kinds of social movements and change that we really need. Because I think we all know that knowledge is not the key driver of more just actions and behavior in the world. We all know a lot of terrible things that are happening that we are not changing our behavior to. So I think there's something about that emotional feeling of injustice and feeling compelled to actually do something about it that is a much deeper layer than we get to by just cognitively thinking about the fact that there's a problem or being aware of a problem. So until we really embrace that, then I think we're really limiting actually the power that knowledge can have in the world.
That was exactly my next question about emotions. yeah, how it seems that artistic methods or doing art is a much better method to express emotions. I mean, you might say that art is an expression of emotion in a way that science is not. But I think you gave a good example of how that comes out. I saw one of your posts on, I think, on Twitter a while back, this map of rural utopias, I think it was called. I think you drew it I think that's how when I maybe originally reached out to do this podcast, but
Yeah.
so cool. It's a really cool picture. It just expressed a lot of, if I remember it correctly, like doubts, but visions, and it's kind of this picture of like a kind of a village landscape with all these different places. How did you come to do that? We'll make sure I link to that in the notes here.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so there through this course on rural utopias, which involved so it's called the mixed classroom that we host at the Urban Future Studio, and it invites policymakers, artists, activists, in this case farmers as well, because we were talking about rural deadlocks and issues in the Netherlands, and also master students. So as a part of that process, we asked all of the practitioners involved in the course to dream up what would, if they could envision a rural utopia or some glimpse or some element of a better future with respect to rural issues in the Netherlands, what would they come up with? And so I received, as a result, all of these different, like someone, made up a new ministry, someone else talked about like a seventh generation day, where we think about, intergenerationally, we take that long-term perspective. Someone mentioned, or I think someone even just like sent a video of by Sarathi Korwar of Utopia is a Colonial Project, as a way of also stating the importance that in the future, when we think about rural futures, we really need to make sure we're not reproducing these colonial utopias, or vegan-based cheese, or yeah, vegan-based cheese shop in the Netherlands. And so I was trying to think, what is some way, these are all in such different formats and disparate documents, is there some way of bringing these different visions together so that people can engage with the plurality of these ideas and how imaginative they are? And that's where the idea of a map came to me, because I thought that's actually a way of kind of representing imaginatively these different ideas without pinning down and having some super realistic vision of a rural future that then actually closes down people's imagination, because, or they react really negatively against it because they're like, well, that's not my utopian vision of a rural future in the Netherlands. I think it's much more powerful sometimes to find these artistic ways of representing multiple imaginations and multiple viewpoints in conversation. And so we also, when we had a reunion event, we thought about what it might be like to kind of walk around this map of rural utopias or this city, and where would people feel compelled to go? What would be the parts of it that they wouldn't want to go, and why? Because there are certainly many different controversial views in there that some people might disagree with as well, as that being a rural utopia. So I'm very intrigued by these kinds of ways of world building that are very open and they provoke our imagination, but without trying to sell us one particular view of a desirable future.
Thinking about co-production and thinking about these new kind of techniques for doing research, I'm also thinking back as for most academics, we're on one hand, we're trying to do research, and on the other hand, we have to teach. Have you thought about the role of co-production and taking these types of new approaches into the classroom and rethinking how we do teaching with students? I mean, that's also in a way kind of a colonial exercise, like someone with knowledge stands at the front and tells a bunch of people who are sitting down what to do. Have you thought about like reshaping classrooms around some of these insights and co-production and creativity and imagining, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's because, in a way, as someone who spends, half of my year teaching, it's such an active, immediate practice, where I can really kind of express and further develop my ideas of how to create these sorts of spaces, which I think students really value, having that space for both really critical perspectives, but also creativity and imagination. And so I was fortunate to have the chance to create a new master's course I ran for the first time with a colleague, Jonas Torrance, in the autumn. And so it's called Imagining the Future for Transformation. And so we tried to create that sort of imaginative feeling in the classroom. And this started from even just what the course guide is like. So I didn't want to send this really dry, boring document that feels like a contract, where students are already kind of, it already sets certain kinds of expectations, I think sometimes in problematic ways. And so I tried to already send this really kind of creative, imaginative document with a playlist, and already asked them to show up, filling in one of the pages of how they picture, and in any kind of way they wanted to represent it, how they picture the future. And one person even showed up with a full-fledged diorama that he had built of himself in the future in a repair shop. And I think kind of setting that space for people to really kind of express their passions from day one, but then also foster a critical discussion. I mean, there were students also that showed up with, like, I don't know, maybe what you could also call a bit more kind of techno utopia, or like an alien invasion. so there, it was a whole range of different perspectives of the future. But the whole point was not to kind of pin down or reify what they brought into the classroom, but really kind of create an open and safe space for exploring the implications of these different perspectives. So I hope that's what we managed to do. And actually, it's good timing because tomorrow I'm about to share online actually a blog post reflection on that experience called Notes on the Utopian Classroom, which are some of my reflections on when you think about trying to build a utopian classroom, what are some of the things that you might actually think through? And it's very much personal reflections on how I've been inspired from others, and how I've tried to experiment with some of those things in my own classroom.
Amazing. Yeah, I wanted to. That was kind of my last question here about this blog that I see that you're, you, what I forget what it's called, Utopia's blog or something like this.
Oh yeah, Utopian Pulses.
Right. Yeah, so I'm interested in the blog format and how important you think it is to have these kind of less formal outlets for writing in academic space. I mean, we're forced to conform into the journal formats and they have their own
Yeah.
world, etc. What motivates you to invest time in this alternative output?
Yeah, I resisted the blog format for a while, even though I thought it might be inspiring, because I thought, oh, I shouldn't be spending time writing that when I really need to write various papers and finish those off. And so I kind of fell into that trap in a way of suppressing that much more free and creative form of writing. But interestingly, I found that it's completely the opposite. So having a really kind of low barrier way to share ideas, also hopefully get much more fluid input and reflections on different ideas that I want to share, it has actually even further inspired my academic writing practice as well. I think it can be a challenge to figure out, like, there are things I've written, and then it's like, oh, should I shift this from it being a blog post into actually a paper? So I think, I think it's challenging to balance both of those different outputs, but I find it a really fruitful combination, because otherwise we're so constrained by being on this limited track of a year or longer sometimes to share our ideas in so many different, sometimes kind of mundane iterative rounds of reframing and changing things, even though there's certainly also a very constructive part of the review process that does improve the ideas in the paper, that I think we need to find our energy in both modes, and much more immediate modes as well.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Josie. This has been really fun conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot.
No, thanks so much for having me, Stefan. I really enjoyed our conversation.
The In Common podcast is the official podcast of the International Association for the Study of the Commons, or IASC. You can find more episodes or resources on our website, www.incommonpodcast.org.